You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here with Lisa Smart. She spells her last name S-M-A-R-T-T, and she is the author of Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. And if you want to know more about her work, you can go to her website, finalwordsproject.org, O-R-G, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. Lisa, I'm reminded when Michael's mother died, she was living in San Francisco. We were living up in Mendocino County. She did everything she could do to make sure that she got up to Mendocino County. It was very, very difficult for her to do that move, but she made sure that she ended up in a nursing home in Mendocino, in the little town that we lived in, Ukiah. And I remember just before she had a stroke, when Michael and I were visiting her in the nursing home, and she said to him, said to both of us, she said, "I'm ready to go home now." And we're looking at each other. At that time, we were traveling a lot in our lives, and there was no way that we could bring her home to our home and care for her like she was being cared for in the nursing home. And she had had a leg amputation, and so she couldn't get around very easily. So we were concerned about that. And then a day later, she had a stroke and ended up in the hospital. And we realized that, oh, she was talking about another kind of home, because then she, after a couple of days in the hospital, she went into a coma. Ah. So it was, but that's what you're talking about, that we get these kind of inklings. It seems we take them literal, but they may be saying something else.
Yes. And, you know, I'm ready to go home now, or I'm coming home, or someone's coming to take me home. Home is probably one of the most frequently heard words at the threshold. And the question is what is that home? And, you know, people talk about meds and you know, those kinds of effects. And my question back is, well, let's say it is all meds. Still, why is everybody talking about home? You know, why is that the hallucination that everybody's having? And there really is a sense that people are preparing to go somewhere, because one of the other metaphors we hear so commonly is of the voyage and of the travel, of going somewhere.
I'm thinking, too, that you've written about a project in England, end-of-life care project. And they give advice about how to be with a loved one as they're dying. And they're looking at it differently from battling the disease, where we're somehow battling the illness, but they are talking about for us to think about it, as you just said, as a journey. We're going home, to use a metaphor of a journey. And that gives an ease to the person.
And it also, from this research, and also Maggie Callahan and Patricia Kelly in their book Final Gifts, talks about the metaphor of the journey. It's more consistent with maybe the real vocabulary of dying. So what they found, metaphor of end-of-life project in the United Kingdom, they found that when people talked about disease, and especially cancer, as battling this illness, you know, you can never win that battle. You're never going to mm-hmm. win. Mm-hmm. But if you talk about a journey of discovery and of surrender and of peace, mm-hmm. and also a metaphor that's so much more closely allied to what seems to be the natural metaphors of the threshold, or at least in English that we know, that is much more comforting to people. And can you imagine? I much prefer to think of anything in my life, anything, whether it's work, a radio interview, loving my husband. I much rather think of any of those things as a journey. That's a much better life narrative and metaphor than a battle, right? I mean, it's exhausting to think of battles. And they found that literally everybody on the medical team and the families felt better about the whole notion of an illness or dying as a journey when they presented it that way rather than a battle. And this is also very, very recent research, and they've put it into public policy now.
That's fantastic. Yeah. You know, I'm also reminded that in talking about all of this, it seems to me that it helps the living to relax more around the person dying, to be able to ease into letting them go into their process. We've all experienced certain people and certain families that keep someone alive and just refuse to even talk about death, or won't even let them talk about it, or that everything's going to be fine, you're going to be well, and yet they really are dying. And it kind of works against them in some way. We've seen this. Do you have any comments on that?
Yes. You know, it seems that we have, or I've come to believe this, that we have an internal sense of when we're supposed to die, even if it's tragically young. I mean, I have a couple accounts of people at age 22 saying, no, I know it's time to go. It's time to go now. And really having a sense of that. If we imagine that we all come here for a known period of time, let's just imagine that. And even if that's not true, to be held in the possibility that it's okay to leave. And we know over and over again from my conversations with hospice workers, the hardest thing for the dying is not dying by the time they're that close, but having to say goodbye or feeling the pain of those around them. The biggest gift we can give the people we love is to open the door, first of our hearts and then of the threshold. And partly the way we do that is enter into the vocabulary of the journey, or whatever that person's vocabulary is, and believe them and not be afraid of it. And that's the gift and the challenge for those of us who are living. We also have heard from so many people who are with their loved ones at the threshold that it can be a magical time. The portal seems to open and sacred synchronicity enters in.
I told you this story before we started the interview, and I am going to tell it a briefer rendition of this story. It has to do with Michael's mother, because this is where when we worry about, oh, did I do the right thing? Did it, you know, that once death has happened, and in the case of his mother, we unplugged her and decided to let her go naturally. And Michael had second thoughts about that afterwards. He, as we were driving home, fact, after she had already died and we had been with her in the hospital, it was so wonderful to let us just sit with her and with her body for, you know, for hours, several hours after she died before they took her away. But Michael nevertheless had a moment pause, did I do the right thing? And just at that moment, it was just an extraordinary thing. On the windshield of the car, there had been a sticker that had just been kind of placed on the bottom right-hand side of the windshield. Had been there for over a year. Mm. It just was just this sticker sitting there. And at that moment that he had that thought, this sticker peels off of the windshield and falls onto the dashboard. Mm. And it says, Grateful Dead Backstage Pass.
Oh.
And it's like, oh, I mean, so this was such a confirmation, the synchronicity of his having the thought and having that outward symbol that, thank you. And in fact, the last words his mother said before she went into the coma was, she said to him, three times, thank you for everything. When she said it at first, he thought, oh, yeah, well, you're welcome, you know, to whatever it was kind of surface. He took it as a surface thank you. And then he started to walk out of her hospital room, and she said it again. Mm. she stopped him and she said, "Thank you for everything." And he said, "Fine, Mother, that's great. You're welcome." And then he gets to the door of the hospital room, and the third time, just like in some fairy tale, mm-hmm. that things come in threes, she says, "Thank you for everything." And when he got home, he told me this story about it really stopped him, and he realized she was saying something more than just thank you. It was like a deep, deep thank you. And those were the last words that she spoke to him.
And commonly, thank you and repeated thank yous occur at the end of life. And also, it sounds like he really heard her. You know, he really deeply heard her. And repetition, we know Steve Jobs,
founder of Apple,
oh,
right.
Oh, thank you.
Yes,
yeah, the founder. Yeah, he repeated, "Oh, wow, oh, wow. Oh, wow."
Those were his very last words.
So we know repetition. And I just read something before I came here today from Bill Stillman, who's a psychic who's also autistic and done a lot of research in language and the language of autism. And he said threes are very highly connected with synchronicity. And he sees this also in the repetitions of people with autism, which is another topic, but that there seems to be these parallels in language, and threes and repetition come up very commonly at end of life. Oh, more, oh, more, oh, more worlds and worlds and worlds.
It gets very poetic, doesn't it?
It does get very poetic. And if you think about chants or incantations, and when we talked earlier about nonsense, when I was younger and I really wanted something, you know, I would say abracadabra, right? Isn't that word?
Yeah.
It's nonsense,
right?
But we have a sense that when we use language that's not part of the usual mainstream narrative or conversational style, when we use language outside of that, it's almost as if we're, you know, asking the gods or bringing in the gods.
Yes.
And when the language changes, it's almost as if the world changes
for us.
It's
like an invocation.
It's like an invocation. And there is a lot of repetition in end-of-life language. And it's so fascinating, too. Seem to appear a lot in synchronicity and synchronistic experiences. Like it might be one, you might see a symbol once, twice, three times, and then it really becomes, that's sort of a sign from spirit.
Exactly. So you're saying, and I know that I've been aware of that, when things come to me in threes, it's like, oh, I better pay attention. This is something, this maybe is something coming from the invisible world to me in some way. And I just want to go back to something that you said. We were talking about someone suddenly becomes very lucid, maybe towards the end, and you think that they're having a rally or some sort, or maybe a spontaneous healing. And I would like to talk about this in just one moment when we come back. And I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Lisa Smart, and she is the author of Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. And if you want to know more about her work, you can go to her website, finalwordsproject.org, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Lisa Smart, and she's the author of Words at the threshold, what we say as we're nearing death. And I was just talking about that moment that somehow our beloved, maybe they've been very, very quiet and very peaceful, but suddenly they rally and they become very lucid. And there's one example that you give in the book that I think it was somebody, White, his mother, I can't remember his first name, but his mother was, she had Alzheimer's. She had had it for a long time, and the actual tissue of the brain has just shrunken, and her brain is really shrunken, and it can't do all the synapses. It's just not doing anything. But suddenly, she raises up, and she is totally cogent and says, here's where the files are, and she just gives all these instructions just before she dies. What is happening there? There's something beyond the brain that is happening, obviously.
And this is one of the things that has really led me to believe more in the idea of survival of consciousness, or at least some kind of consciousness besides the brain, the physical brain. And doctors in the past have said this is due to a surge of adrenaline before people die, which is possible, and yet, you know, you look at someone like that whose brain is clinically almost non-existent, right? There's none of the synapses are working, and yet that kind of description. Or something like someone who is in a coma comes up and turns to her family and says, tell everyone I love them and I'm okay. Or someone who comes up and says, it's not what you think. Also, people make requests for food during this window of time, and sometimes it's for a few minutes, and sometimes it might be for a whole day. It's also called the sunset day, where there's, you know how with the sunset, just before it goes down, there's this lightening of the sky or brightening
yes.
of the sky. And one story that I loved is that there was one father-in-law who was sort of teased this woman about the way she looked. Not a nice thing to do, but that was his idea of teasing her. And just before he died, in this window of lucidity, he asked for a beer and also turned to her and said, I never noticed how beautiful you are. And so in those windows of lucidity that happen commonly, and researchers now are just getting to look at these cases, people don't say, you were the worst daughter-in-law I've ever seen. It's almost as if they look through the eyes of Source, or they see the things they may not saw before, appreciate the things they may not have fully appreciated, or they offer guidance to their loved ones. And food is often involved, which is that last burst of enjoying life and sort of the sweetness of life.
I can remember just a day, the last day for Michael, my partner, And he was in the last stages of diabetes, and he said, "Oh, Justine, I really need ice cream. Can you go get me a Ben and Jerry's?" You know, and I was so distraught. Like, how can I give him this poison? You know, I was thinking of it like poison. And I talked to the nurse practitioner, and I said, "He's asking for ice cream," and she just looked at me and she said, "Get him whatever he wants." And so I did. I went and I got him some Ben and Jerry's. And I don't think that he actually ate it. But, I brought it back to him and just relaxed into it. And, and I think that final sweetness is what he was asking for. It had something to do with some sweetness.
I think so. Yeah, it's funny you should mention that, because my grandmother asked to have chocolate shaved onto her tongue, and she joked that she wanted to see God with a little sweetness on her tongue. Oh, but, maybe there was more to that than my joking grandmother. You know, maybe there is that sense that we want to return to our Creator with some sweetness.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's talk. You've done a little bit of work around comas and how even when someone is very quiet or even in a coma, they might, it's almost like they're telepathic. Can you say something about that?
I write about it in the book, and most of what I found out was from interviews with Madeline Lawrence, who did a book about coma survivors called In a World of Their Own. And what she said, 70% of the survivors who she interviewed indicated they had some kind of awareness during the time that they were in coma. And I believe it was 23% had experiences of telepathic understanding that were later corroborated. For example, one person she describes knew that the doctor and the nurse in the room were having an affair. I mean, here she was completely unresponsive, but she was whatever that, you know, William James called it me-ness, you know, that, yes. that me in us that continues even when it seems there's very little else going on externally. These people reported being aware in some way. And in this case, this woman knew what was going on between the nurse and the doctor. And so there definitely is some kind of something that continues on, or at least in during coma. And, you know, a lot of the people who survived comas reported to Lawrence that they felt like they were repeatedly, they heard people talk about them as vegetables, and they were literally offended because they knew that there was this thing alive in them that maybe couldn't be expressed through their fingertips or, you know, definitely through their mouths. But they had a sense still of being very much with us.
You know, my experience, especially like my personal experience when my mother died, and I was with her in that last 24 hours. It seemed like that night before she died, and I was sitting with her, I had this intuitive feeling that the energies were very, very subtle, and that to speak out loud would have disturbed things in some ways. And I know you talk about being silent and savoring. And in that moment, I just sat with her, and I didn't say a word, but I was just sitting there, and I was loving her. I was just sending love to her. And then suddenly, she reached over and took my hand, and she said, "I know, I know." I hadn't said a word, and it's like she heard my expression of love. She could hear it as if I had said the words. I did not articulate the words, and that's what you're talking about, that telepathic, energetic moment that's so, what's the word for it? It's very subtle and very special. It's a very sacred space.
Yes. You know, Rumi said, without thinking of the letters, listen to the language of the heart. And it really seems that among the different ways communication is expressed at end of life, one of them is telepathically. And again, here is another opportunity, rather than being afraid, is, as you mentioned, is to savor this silence as if we are in prayer or in meditation. And one of the people I interviewed, Sue Ronenkamp, shared this story very similar to yours, where she was really felt heartbroken that her mother was no longer speaking with her and they didn't have that communication she was accustomed to. And so she decided to just sit there and communicate. Imagine she was communicating and sending love, just as you had explained. And she did that for 40 minutes. And then the nurse's aide came in and asked if they needed lunch or anything. And then the mother opened her eyes and said, Oh, everything's fine. I've been having the most amazing conversation with my daughter. So again, communication, and this is one of the things I've learned through this research. I used to think communication was just one thing, you know, me the cup or, you know, but it's communication, and we see this at the threshold more than at any other time besides maybe childhood. It is multi-layered, and it includes nonverbal connections of many kinds. We know that people, before they die, they'll also at the very end maybe reach upward as if they're reaching up towards someone. I just spoke to someone 2 days ago who shared this story. His father's muscles were completely atrophied from being in a coma and just completely atrophied. And right before he died, about 8 hours, he reached up his hands and arms and said, "Mom, Mom." Again, remarkable.
Remarkable. And so just paying attention to be quiet enough with our loved ones, our beloved, to be able to experience fully that moment. And sometimes I know it might be hard if it's a hospital room and there's all sorts of things going on, but as best we can to just be very quiet and as we can and receive that deep listening, I guess, is what we're talking about.
You know, what's so difficult, I think, is that we're losing someone we love and our grief is so powerful. Of course it's so powerful. And I know with this gentleman who told me the story about his father,
yes,
he didn't make the connection until he and I had this conversation that it was actually a hopeful thing that his father reached up and said, "Mom." At the moment, he thought, "Oh, God, Dad's crazy. This, and, you know, I'm terrified. I'm losing him. He's having hallucinations." He didn't even entertain the idea because, first, the grief had overcome him, as it does for most of us. And also still this idea that when we hear our loved ones say things we've never heard before that seem unique, that that's craziness or something discouraging. But I really don't think it is at all. Yeah.
Oh, we could just go on and on. I've lost track of time being with you. Thank you so much, Lisa, for being with us today.
It's been a total pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure as well. I've been speaking with Lisa Smart. She spells her last name S-M-A-R-T-T. If you'd like to know more about her work, you can go to her website, finalwordsproject.org, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. She's the author of Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3615.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over 4 decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Carl Greer, author of Change the Story of Your Health. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about using shamanic and Jungian techniques for healing.
The Bill Reed Gallery presents Bright Futures, an exhibition that brings together the innovative art of Bill Reed with new works by contemporary, emerging, and established Indigenous artists of the Northwest Coast until January 14th, 2024. To celebrate the life of Bill Reed 25 years after his death, contributing artists were invited to ponder and critique the question, how is Bill Reed continuously inspiring contemporary Northwest Coast artists? To learn more about this exhibition, visit billreedgallery.ca.